Radio as we continue to dispel the mythmakers of this world and keep pointing towards the parasites that seek to corrupt, control, and dominate us. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. RedIceCreations.com is the website. I'm Henrik, and we are glad, as always, to have you along with us today. We have an important topic for you, the Irish Holocaust. The what? I've never heard about that. Well, exactly. That's just it. It seems that only some atrocities deserve worldwide attention, with museums, monuments, and memorials erected in basically every major city around the globe, with accompanying movies, TV programs, and specials dedicated to the subject, virtually blanketing all the other atrocities in this world, having them largely go unnoticed. This is, of course, due to the control of the media, the old media, the dying media. Well, this is a very important story, and we have with us Chris Fogarty to talk more about the Irish Holocaust. He was raised on a farm in Ireland where he worked the land with his father and later went on to reside in the U.S. Mr. Fogarty has been a regular columnist for the past 19 years in Irish American News and is a citizen investigator of Chicago aldermanic crime. He is the author of Ireland, 1845 to 1850, The Perfect Holocaust, and Who Kept It, quote, Perfect, unquote. Well, Chris has been running the website irishholocaust.org for many years now, and this is a story we never hear about. It's a very important topic, and we're very glad to finally have him with us on the program. Hey, Mr. Fogarty, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for coming on. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell us when you started irishholocaust.org, and of course, when you came across some of the material indicating that what is known as the Irish potato famine indeed is a big lie.
Well, it's been pretty rough. I was doing my grandfather, my paternal grandfather's biography in the public record office at the time, now in outside London, in Kew, outside London in Surrey. And now it's called, by the way, the National Archives. But in any event, while going through his records, and he was a British soldier, I'm now embarrassed. I've learned to be embarrassed to say. But he was a member of the 40th Regiment of Foot, that when he was a child of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age and 10, was removing the food from South County Galway. And I said, this is really strange. I always thought that it was a failure of a crop that was grown throughout the country, the failure of the only crop they lived on, and that they died as a consequence. And so I examined further, and I found that more than half of the of Britain's Empire Army at the time were in Ireland removing the food at gunpoint. That was completely new to me. And so I put the word out a little bit and got a lot of negatives back from the British government, the Irish government. The FBI raided us a number of times, locked up my wife and me on charges that we proved 15 months later were fabricated. So there's a major effort to keep this particular genocide covered up.
But why did the FBI get involved in this? You're just looking into history here. What people did you approach to try to get answers here? Why did this happen?
Well, I went to the Irish consulate, and I went to the British consulate, and I went through a bunch of books and talked to a lot of professors, and I found it was almost universal. They insisted that nothing should be looked at here, that there was nothing to see here.
Right.
And so I don't... You see, in Ireland, even to this day, anyone who wants to talk about this completely covered-up genocide are smeared as being Republican. And Republican now is a new word for terrorist.
Sure.
Despite the readily available homicide records that shows that the British are now and always have been the main terrorists. But the news media are so corrupt that the people in Ireland itself, in the Republic, not in the North, they know there because they've been in it, but in the Republic, the majority of the population believe that the IRA are terrorists. They've been led to believe that, and that's a shame.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about some of the what's going on today a little bit later, some of the media and reception and why people are reluctant not to talk about it, etc. But let's go back in time here a little bit then and talk a little bit about the precursor. The period we're focusing on here is around 1845 to 1850. But let me ask you first, what was the precursor? What enabled this to occur? What was the reasoning behind this, do you think?
Yes, there was an invasion of Ireland, and the British completely took over the country. Some 95% of the land of Ireland was claimed and operated by British so-called owners. They extracted from Ireland at the time all the goods that was therein. And at the time, most of those goods were the energy of the people and the fertility of the soil. And so they removed essentially all of Ireland's produce every year into the European market for sale. They used the British Army all those earlier years also. And in fact, a wonderful British MP, William Cobbett, C-O-B-B-E-T-T, in the early 1830s, visited Ireland. And his book alone, Cobbett in Ireland, describes what he sees, and he knows that it's an international crime and that the Irish, who are exporting food in huge amounts of all kinds, meat and poultry products, grains, flour, the whole range of things into Britain and essentially feeding its overseas army, that the people growing it were kept on the very edge of death by starvation themselves. He described it very well throughout Munster, the southern half of Ireland. And it speaks for itself. We have the landing, the London Times of the Times newspaper lists the landings of Irish food in England, in Britain, all those years, and right through the so-called famine of Ireland, the Holocaust, and that never stopped. In fact, it increased when the people became hungry. They wiped out about half of the indigenous Irish population. And that was done largely in it. My book that has just come out there, I think you might have the cover of it, is the first time published since the 1870s, the political power of the landlords, of the British landlords in Ireland. They were the ones who created the laws that gave themselves Ireland's food. They created the laws that sent in the British Army into Ireland to remove the food at gunpoint to their vast wealth. They lived like rajahs at the time. The big house across Ireland to this day and castles were the landlords' houses. They typically had 20 or 30 or 50,000 acres. One had nearly 200,000 acres. And they extracted through their British Army and other forces everything grown thereupon. There was no army of British or English spalpeens, agricultural harvesters and planters going into Ireland every year to plant and harvest those crops. That was all the brains and the work of the Irish people, but they were robbed of it, and that robbery went on for centuries.
Let's talk a little bit about the destruction here of an ancient culture like Ireland and the fact that this is done, you know, on the European continent as well. The very aspect that they had a very long-standing conflict with the Irish as well, something that's not widely known. But what's shocking here to me is the food removal regiments. And so did the British see this as an attempt to extract wealth from Ireland, ultimately to feed other people themselves perhaps? Or was this, is there something more behind it? Is there something more that they were seeking to destroy the Irish for some reason?
Yeah, they were seeking to destroy because, for example, I think it was Nassau Senior, an economic advisor to Queen Victoria at the time, said that an Irishman will soon be as rare upon the banks of the Shannon as a redskin on the banks of the Manhattan. There is no Manhattan, but that's what he said anyways. And so that was the intention. That was what they were hoping for. And they won't admit that today. The lie continues. Tony Blair, some 10 years ago, continued the lie when he so-called apologized. He said that Britain had stood by while the Irish starved to death. And sending in more than half of your empire army into Ireland to perpetrate that genocide is not standing by. That's a shocking lie. And what's more, the Irish government and most of the news media spokespeople praised him for accepting that so-called responsibility on the part of his nation.
Right, yeah. Now, let's talk about the official story a little bit, though, what people hear. The, you know, potato blight, it's a horrible disease that struck you, you know, but how does this story get started? What's the official story? And let's break that down and why you say that that's lies.
Well, on November 3rd, 1845, a 22-man delegation of Irish indigenous people went to the British Viceroy in Dublin, Lord Heytesbury. They begged him to stop the food removal, that people were starting to die of starvation. And he listened to them briefly and then read to them from a paper about potatoes and potato blight, and then which he poo-pooed, which he disparaged, and then sent them away. So two things happened on that day: the official beginning of that genocide and the beginning of the potato famine lie. The potato crop did fail, but that was only one crop. It'd be about as significant as pizza pie disappearing from American cities. It just would not make any terrible difference. Now, the fact that the English landlords in Ireland had told the Irish people the non-existent potatoes are exclusively yours, that is your exclusive claim on us, we're taking everything else you're growing, that was done. So, but now they're saying that the Irish relied upon the potato. Could it be reasonably said that people who grow beef and mutton and pork and poultry and milk the cows and make butter and plant and sow wheat and oats and barley and rye, why would those who grow all that be said to rely on one crop only?
Right. I was in precursor to the show here, reading a little bit more about this. I was curious, trying to find out some of the numbers here, and I think it was on potato.ie that it says that in 1845, 2,516,000 acres were tilled with potatoes in Ireland. This fell to just 1 million acres in 1846 and to a much reduced 248,000 acres in 1847. Now, do you know if that's true? Is that made up? Or what's the score there with the potatoes then?
If there's any connection to academia or to official figures of government, it's almost certainly a lie. The most truthful writer about this, Cecil Woodham Smith, in her The Great Hunger, Ireland 1845, 18 The Great Hunger, she wrote throughout her book, and I point out her 12 major lies, while she, for the first time in history, she named 13 of the food removal regiments and the conditions under which they were removing the food. For that, she was smeared for the next two or three decades. She went through an unbelievable smearing campaign by British and Irish academia. But she wrote that there was not a green field from Cape Clear to Malin Head, which is nonsense, because only one crop failed, and the notion that all crops failed and that grass even stopped growing is just crazy. But the lies continue. Christine Keneally is the main big lie operative today. She continues to cover up, though she's moving. She was accosted a number of times along the East Coast by people of the United States, people carrying my pamphlet and asking her why she's covering up for the food removal.
Right.
So, and why she's denying that Irish food was being sent to England in those years. She started to write then, after that, about the removal of Irish food, but removed the compulsion part of it. She will not mention the fact of the British Army in Ireland. She just refuses to comment on that. So she's covering up. In fact, when another Irish academic and economist, Cormac O'Grada, wrote his book, The Great Irish Famine, she praised it and said that it was going to demolish a number of myths that have been passed glibly down from generation to generation, that of overcrowded cemeteries and food leaving Ireland and going to England and a couple of things like that. And so in her later books, after having been accosted by people carrying my pamphlet at the time, she did admit the food that, in fact, she later said that 4,000 shiploads of Irish grain alone entered Liverpool Harbor alone in 1847 alone, completely contradicting her earlier published work.
Yeah, interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit more about here. There is a lot of things going on in Ireland and to the Irish people at the time and a long time prior as well to this. But, of course, you did have a lot of poverty. You had a high amount of servitude. There was also, of course, coupled with this, a lot of Irish slaves. They call them indentured servants. But in some cases, they were actually worked harder. They were worked to death in some cases because many people didn't pay for these slaves as they did with other slaves, like with black slaves, for example, and they were therefore more highly valued. But Irish people that were taken off the streets were actually taken there by force and worked to death during a 5 to 7 year period. But, you know, they say, I was getting to the poverty issue here, that, you know, sometimes between, you know, the 1600s to the 1800s, the potato was brought into Ireland, and at some point, they say it became the staple food. That initially was kind of a supplement vegetable by everybody, but then a lot of the poor, they started kind of replacing that with other food and stuff like that. And one of the numbers I pulled out was they said that an adult male averaged about 10 to 12 pounds of potatoes, you know, per day among the poor anyway. So obviously this would be a convenient way of saying that if something happened to the potato, then, of course, yeah, everyone would starve. And it was kind of, it feels like it's very much appropriative that this occurred then to them, that this bug moved in, because now they can blame the potato and not recognize that the other food was actually taken out from Ireland, right?
That's right. In fact, the focusing upon the 10 pounds is an attention-getting statement that guides the mind towards thinking about potatoes. And it's a little bit like, the British government here in Chicago, back in about 1997 or 8, brought in a cross that is said to have been made from the boards of a hinged bottom coffin that was used to bury the so-called famine victims at the time. And so by bringing in this cross and turning it into a kind of a revered icon, and by the way, shown around Catholic churches here in Chicago and other Catholic churches across the country, the icon or the image becomes that of a cross and the sad case of the deaths of the people. Not a single mention of why did they die. And so that goes on constantly. There's almost, well, even a brand new lie had to be created. Once the volume of food leaving Ireland and going to England was no longer recoverable, concealable, because it's throughout the Times newspaper, a brand new lie was fabricated to cover that, so that you don't have to mention the British Army. Once you mention the food removal, at gunpoint food removal, the game is up. Then there's no longer famine. Then it's obviously genocide.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep the lie going, they have developed a brand new one to buttress it, and that is that it was the rich Irish starving the poor Irish.
Right, okay, yeah, like it was an internal thing, not looking at the British Empire. Now, can you give us an idea about how much food actually was taken away? You actually have some statistics on your website. Can you recall some of this easily?
I can't. It's beyond count. It's probably 10 million head of cattle and many millions of head of sheep, and the pigs went out both in brine, both butchered and live. It was a complete torrent. The only word to use for that is a torrent of food left out, uncountable amounts. It's there. After I went through enough of Times's reports, very, very, very lengthy reports of landings in London and Liverpool and Bristol and other places of Irish food, I didn't bother collecting too many of them because they all say the same thing. And so I focused more upon where in Ireland the food removal regiments were, and the lies told even at that time. On the other hand, Tim Pat Coogan wrote a book last year, 2 years ago, entitled The Famine Plot, in which, to make his case that it was a genocide, he cites the correspondence of the bureaucrats, the English bureaucrats in Ireland at that time. And he makes his case to the extent that the ill will of the bureaucracy can be considered enough to wipe out 5.2 million people. I don't think it can. It tends to corroborate what later happened, but it doesn't prove what happened.
Now, let me ask you about, I guess I want to reiterate as well, I think you said on the website about 40 to 70 shiploads per day was removed at gunpoint by about 12,000 British constables, reinforced, of course, by the British militia, battleships, other vessels, Coast Guard, etc. That's an awful lot of British troops that was in the country at the time then. I think around 200,000 British troops were involved in this.
Approximately that amount, but they were not all in the country at the same time. That statement of mine that I wrote could be a little misleading. It's important to note about 200,000 British troops participated in the genocide of Ireland, but not from the beginning to the end.
Okay.
They came and went.
Right.
The constables were there at all times, maxing out at 12,900, between 12,500 and 12,900. And the militia were there at all times, and they did their deadly work. And it was only when the two forces combined, well, the first force to remove the food were the constables. When they ran into trouble, they summoned the local militia. When the two of them together were having trouble removing the food, they summoned the nearest army, British Army detachment, and the British Army never failed to remove the food.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, you have one section on your website where you go into the idea that this was, of course, official, British intent, that there was a number of people talking about this. A lot of it had to do with British, claim and ownership of Irish lands as well, that they wanted to try to gain control of Ireland. Was this just kind of a part of an expansion phase, do you think, of the British Empire itself? Or again, was there a deeper-rooted resentment for the Irish people for some reason? I've always wondered about that. I mean, you had books coming out called, The Irish Question and things like that, and like they were needed to deal with this problem. Have you researched anything of what was the backdrop of that? What was the reason for that?
Well, it was bad enough prior to the Reformation, but the Reformation gave another faith-based reason to consider the Irish subhuman, that they were Catholics. When the British people had become Episcopalian and Presbyterian and Methodist, so their true hatred really got going, in my opinion, by the difference in religions.
Right. Okay.
And I heard Ian Paisley. I was in his church back only about 25 years ago, the Church of the Holy Martyrs in Belfast, and he was in building Toronto at the time on a money-seeking effort. But a Reverend John Wiley or Kiley spoke in his place. And he had people, he said, turn to your Bible, look at Nehemiah in your Bible. And people were reading, I was astonished. It referred to the dangerous times in the province and the terrible state to which the province had fallen. And that's in the Bible. And he says, and when the Gorvalard wrote province, he was talking about Northern Ireland. So he says, when you leave here today, he says, get up off your feet, he says, get off of your seat, he says, and get out there, he says, and wipe off the face of the earth that God-cursed system of Romism. And he says, if you're old or if you're sick, he says, get someone to do it for you.
Right.
So that was in a church, that was just 25 years ago, or 20 years, sometime around.
Sure. Well, exactly. I mean, the battles in Ireland has been, specifically in Northern Ireland, has been horrendous between the different religious factions,
Well, it was the same earlier on, and the British, I don't refer to them so much as Protestants as much as I do British, because that is what, they get their power, they get their moral power, if you want to call it that, the incentive from their religion, but they get their firepower from civic sources, from national sources. And it's important here to say, to counter that new lie, because it is really spreading, that it was the rich Irish starving the poor Irish. Between 1900 and 1910, the British government forced its landlords in Ireland out of the country. It bought them out, left them no option. They had to accept. It bought them out, repatriated them to England, or they went on their own accord, those who weren't living in England already. And the land of Ireland was redistributed to its producers, to its the land tillers. So that Ireland today is the most well-distributed nation in Europe regarding land ownership. But that happened, all of it, between 1900 and 1910.
Right, yeah.
And my father was still paying, along with all of his neighbors, and I suppose the rest of the country, annual rent to amortize the sum, the above market sums that were paid to the old English landlords between 1900 and 1910.
Mm-hmm.
And they were paying that up through the 1960s.
Wow.
Ireland only became semi-prosperous after that annual leaching of all of the agricultural profit of Ireland,
right,
out of Ireland to England, all the way up into the mid-1960s.
Yeah, it's amazing how long that is drawn out in that capacity, how victims are forced to, you know, pay in that regard and continue to be indebted to some of the other countries that defeated them, if you will. But let's talk about the toll of the Holocaust. This is an interesting question here. How many people died? You've done some of the math on this. You've tried to look at the population statistics at the time and how many were left after all of this was said and done. Talk about the numbers a little bit.
Yes. First of all, it must be recognized that the people who were taking the censuses in those years were the constabulary. They were English-led. All the officers, the ranking officers, were all English. And so the people were scared to death of them and would flee them. And they were the first force going in there, and they carried carbines. And all those years they carried carbines, not just billy clubs, but carbines. And so the people feared them, and the notion that they would also then count the people is really bizarre. So there's good reason to believe, according to some recounts that were made by a captain, name doesn't come to me now, down in Clare, that and Cecil Woodham Smith in her book said that the undercount was about one third in 1841. And so it seems that it was between 12 and 13 million people in the country at the time. When it was over, there was 5. Some million. And I must say, I'm a little weak now on these figures, but the figures I came up with at the time was about 5.2 million. Now, I've since been talking with a man who specializes in censuses and how they're put together, and he has written the paragraph on population reduction in my new book. And I'm very glad he did it, because I've been very, very, very severely attacked by this. And I ask people, look at the figures and do them for yourself. But they don't want to do that.
Right.
They just want to hear.
Yeah, that's strange. So what are we talking about here numbers-wise, then? I think you mentioned about 6,257,000 on the website.
Yes, that would be the total population reduction, I gather.
Yeah, wow, that's a lot.
That's a lot, and I think about 1 million successfully fled. But my new book shows the numbers of many, many, many thousands that died in Toronto and Ottawa and Quebec and Gros Isle and Montreal. It's just stunning the amount of... There were thousands of people being treated out in the open for typhus in 1847 in the grounds of a cathedral in Montreal, not far from where they landed. And they were being treated in the open air in Canada. And there were trenches alongside their tents where they were. And they were buried right beside where they were living out of doors in tents.
So, just explain that to us a little bit. These are the people then that had fled to America to get away from some of these conditions. Is that correct?
Yes, and the death toll among them was stunning. I'm still thinking that perhaps 1 million of them did survive. And so, if you take 1 million from the 6.3 or 4 million, whatever, I've thought that, trying to be conservative, that perhaps around 5.2 million were murdered.
And, of course, this creates an awful lot of bodies, skeleton, archaeological finds. Let's talk now then about the map that you have on your website that details this, which shows the mass graves. 6 million people, that's an awful lot of bodies. And, of course, you'll have a lot of proof for this once you begin to dig into the ground, right? So tell us about the maps and how widely distributed this was.
Well, they were buried in piles, you see. It's not as if they were each given a separate grave. They were buried in piles. And the number of mass graves I show on that map is something like 170 or so, something like that, across Ireland. The number is probably more than 10 times that, maybe even 20 times that. The mass grave where my wife and I put up a memorial back in 2000 is not on that map, in Ballyglass, Ballymoe, County Galway.
Okay, yeah.
Where a village was wiped off the face of the earth. And they were not given Christian burial. They were buried as far away from the cemetery, but in the opposite direction, across fences. They were buried in the bog where the digging was easy, and that's where they were buried. And we put up a memorial at that mass grave. And the only reason we know it's a mass grave is that the farmer, when he was given that new land as a land grant, or to be paid for over nearly 100 years, for 50 some years, on his first spring on that land, he ran his plow into a mass grave. The bodies were so thick there, and the area was so large, that he didn't, instead of exhuming them and giving them a Christian burial, which they would have done if the numbers were smaller, he just left that there and never plowed that field again, even though it was the optimum field for tillage. That field, wow. To this day, that field has never been tilled.
All the sites that you have marked, and of course we're going to have this linked up on our website so people can look at this image now as we speak and talk about this. And of course you show the British regiments that of course are also close to a lot of these mass graves, right, in these different, you know, the different counties here. But have all of these sites that you mark been confirmed? How did you come to this conclusion? How did you put the cross marking the mass grave on the map?
By driving around Ireland and asking the local people, and where's the local mass grave? And in the towns, the majority of those mass graves were workhouses, in which each of them, thousands of people entered. Very, very few ever left alive. And so the majority of those mass graves, of those crosses, are where workhouses were. And in fact, even though about five or six of those crosses are on sites where the workhouse was not built until 1850, I still included it because the killing had not all ended in 1850.
Right.
So I left them there. But that is only the number of crosses you see there are only a taste, because I've now determined that according to what I've discovered since then, in areas of fertile ground, the mass graves are typically a mile or two apart, a double carry, in other words, carry from each direction. And so that'd be more than 3,000 mass graves in Ireland. And of course, then there are all kinds of scattered people. People died in ones and twos.
No one ever knew that they were there. Maybe they're just forgotten bodies that were, because at a position like that, when people are starving, as they were in Ukraine, right? The Holodomor is one of these other instigated mass famines in the Ukraine. Of course, people are unable to, unfortunately, help others. They're, you know, it's kind of a pushing the complete reset button on a country, because no one is going to know anything after this is said and done. It's like a clean slate almost. And the British, of course, took advantage of this and could take control of the country after this, you know?
That's what happened. And by the way, that's what ended the Irish language in Ireland. The people who died were almost entirely Irish-speaking, monolingually Irish-speaking. And so that's pretty much wiped out the Irish language. It's
Gaelic you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that pretty much ended that. In our where we had our little farm in County Roscommon, on the east side of town, the land is very good and is good all the way to Strokes Town and Roscommon Town. And in that area, there were essentially no Irish, except minders of cattle and horse grooms and gardeners and things like that. The Irish survived, actually, by living in the areas of badland, up in the mountains and in the bogs, and just trying to squeeze a living out of some little plot somewhere. And I'm also, this is not a dead certainty, but it seems it's true. On the far side of our town, the last High King of all Ireland, that is his direct descendants, still live. It's the house of the O'Connor Dunn. Five families in Ireland were allowed to survive and were not stripped of their legal personhood. Five families. All the rest were the enemy to be killed by any English person at will at any time. Any man, woman, or child, except for five families, had no legal personhood. Therefore, you couldn't murder them because you can only murder a person, and they were not legally they were not legal persons. And so that's how the country was run for a long time. But on that estate of the O'Connor Dunn, many, many hundreds of families survived on 2 and 3 acres all those years. And they were later given economically viable holdings of 28 or 30 acres over on our side of the town, Castleby Town, where they then have been living ever since. But they lived their years of starvation on the little plots of land where they were allowed to live, having been cleansed, completely removed from the rich land where our farm was later set up.
Why were five families...
Terribly, terribly sad story. And but in a certain sense, the decision to perpetrate the genocide that was made by a government at that time, to me, is less horrifying than that the people of Ireland are too intimidated, too fearful to mention it to this day.
Right.
That, to me, that is shocking. I'm in touch with a priest. I heard from him last night, and I think he's giving up. After having read my book and becoming familiar with the material, he wanted to put a monument over the mass grave nearest to where his mother was born in Northwest Mayo. And he's been in touch with the monument maker there, and he's been in touch with his cousins there, and they're too fearful to encourage him or to let it go forward. They're blocking him. And I've been blocked many, many, many times. And by the way, U.S. academia is now involved in that. There was a dig in County Roscommon, in a place called Ballykilcline, where the people were evicted off their land in those years and died in huge numbers crossing to the States. But they're told to this day that they grew only one crop, potatoes. Now, in the excavation of where that entirely wiped out village once stood, a professor Orser from the University of Illinois and his group of students spent a number of summers there excavating that area, and they, at the Percy French Hotel in Strokestown, they labeled everything they found. One of the things they found was a reaping hook, what we used to always call a reaping hook, the forerunner of the scythe, a one-handed scythe,
mm-hmm.
It's called a sickle, and
right.
Everyone is familiar with the shape of it because of the hammer and sickle.
Yep.
Well, that was declared to be an unknowable object that they could not put a name on. Everything else was in cases with name tags along them, but there was no tag on that. I said, why isn't the reaping hook named? They did not want to know that. So they went ahead and they made a film of the whole of their years there, and they used balloons going up with cameras, and they used subterranean cameras and all kinds of things. And so they've determined that it was, after all, a potato famine. And that has come out of an American university, the University of Illinois.
Sure. Well, that was what I kind of was going to say here, that even if they do decide to excavate somewhere, they would just, of course, blame the potato famine. But you mentioned then that a few of these sites have been investigated, a few mass graves have been found here and there. Can you just give us an idea of how you think, how many there might be out there that are not yet dug up, or have you led any kind of work to try to get people to actually... dig at some of these sites and stuff like that to get more information about what happened?
What's happening is that the local people up until the time I left there, and even more recently, they know where they are, and they'll even quietly whisper about them to their peers. But I fear that they have not told their youngsters. That's my fear, that this might be the very time when the mass graves of Ireland are being concealed for the last time, that there'll be no need. I'm afraid that's what's going on. And it is just sad beyond word that this is a conspiracy that is being no longer, is being led by Britain, but it is being implemented by the Irish people themselves. And by the way, the people of Ireland, when we put up the two memorials, it attracted a lot of attention. And four different groups came to us, present at the inauguration, consecration of that one memorial of the murdered Lisnabinney village. They told us about their own mass graves. And if we could get involved, they couldn't do it themselves because it was too dangerous. But could we put up a memorial over their mass graves? We said we could, but they would have to stand up and be the local recipients and responsible for parties for it. Well, it turns out that one of them was near that Ballyclick Kilcline group, and that couple participated later in that particular cover-up. Another one is in Aildoche, Kilkill, Bantry County, Cork, and they don't want to do anything. And so we've learned to our sadness that people are too afraid. Now, these people were very anxious to do it themselves, but they have found that their betters, quote, betters, unquote, are opposed. And Ireland is very much, it remains, from its old English days, a very class-ridden society, and people are very afraid of their, quote, betters, unquote. One group that was present that day from the nearby, only about 2 miles away, Kilbegnet, there's a mass grave there outside a cemetery wall. And they told me about it. I went to see it. And they wanted me to put up a memorial over that mass grave outside the consecrated ground. I agreed to do it. And meanwhile, someone must have told the parish priest because the bishop got involved. And he made a big show. After 150 years of doing nothing, or 160 years, he had the wall expanded to include that mass grave area, the so-called famine ground, and he called it the inclusion of the unbaptized children into the consecrated ground, because Catholic Church theology has changed. It now regrets having declared unbaptized children to be in limbo to eternity, to never see the face of God for eternity. So they've abandoned that. Now they're saying that that particular part of Catholic thinking is no longer appropriate. But they expanded a wall. They built they removed part of the cemetery wall that had stood there for probably 250 years. They expanded it to include where those who had been murdered, the baptized Catholics had been murdered between 1845 and 1850, and they called it inclusion of the unbaptized children.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, let's see. Let me ask you here more about... Well, I wanted to preface as well a little bit that this cover-up by that we're talking about here as well is from laid down, of course, by the British establishment. It's not your run-of-the-mill Angle or Saxon here. We're talking about an elite segment, in some cases even a foreign, when we actually look at the controllers of the British armies at the time and all that kind of thing. But why do you think that they're so, you know, afraid to touch the issue today? It's not like the British would rain down on them today. What is it, psychological? What's at the root of this, do you think?
I'm baffled by it, but when I lived in Ireland, to make any kind of progress, well, it was said to get rich, you had to have a son of a priest and bull your own cows. That is, keep a bull, and that you get. But I remember that any of the benefits that comes from the community, like tertiary education and government grants and things like that, it's all done by political connection. And if your betters, quote, betters, unquote, do not smile upon you, you're in for a rough go in Ireland. And so that's why I think that they can get the otherwise decent people who do want to honor those who were murdered. they are intimidated, but they're selling out too cheaply, in my opinion, because the worst that can happen is that their local bettors will stop smiling at them, and they fear that.
Okay.
Now they'll also withdraw certain governmental benefits and also scholarships for children and things like that. Maybe it all adds up to something important.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to go back because there was something that was unclear that I didn't quite understand. But you mentioned the five families that were allowed to live. What was the reason for that? Why were they left alone or allowed to continue?
That's a good. Evidently, the British needed them to try and control the rest of the population.
Ah, okay, I see. It's the all right. I got you. Yeah, that makes sense from a military strategic point of view. So, do you think at all that it might be a side, you know, question and not really fundamentally related, but I'm just curious. You know, as you said, people were speaking Gaelic. Yes, a lot of people had converted to Catholicism, of course, at the time. And there was a struggle between Protestantism and Catholicism in the country. But do you think that there were any, was people in Ireland, they have still to this day a lot of folk tales and story tales. They have a lot of songs and things like that. Do you think that it's possible at the time as well that the people, the native people of Ireland, were still kind of hanging on to their old beliefs from pre-Christian times?
No, I think the whole nation had become Christian after Patrick in the year 432. It didn't take long. And they seemed to have thriven under Christianity. When the lights went out across Europe, missionaries went out and they founded monasteries in different parts. For example, the Salzburg Cathedral was in it some years ago, and it was built to its current very large footprint by Bishop Fergal from Ireland. He called Fergal the geometer, so he must also have been a map maker or some kind of an engineer. So at that time, Ireland was enlightened, but and at the Reformation, the British came in with bigger guns than ever and decided to wipe out Catholicism under. Henry VIII had little to do with it, even though he was the agent of the Reformation. But his daughter, Queen Elizabeth I, she was wiping out the population, and followed up by the two Jameses and Cromwell. Cromwell issued a law that by May 1st, 1652, any Catholic found east of the Shannon would be shot on sight or sent into slavery He later brought a few shiploads of Irish slaves down to the Caribbean. They called it at the time the Barbados, one of the islands being Barbados, of course.
Yeah, and by the way, Chris, I just want to mention that a lot of Irish people were taken there as well, and they were treated horribly later on, too, when actually the British pulled out and stuff like that. And a lot of Irish people were actually murdered. There's another section there that many people don't know about. But as I said before, a lot of Irish slaves were taken to various places around the American colonies and the Caribbean and stuff like that. So I thought that was an interesting piece to mention there.
Yeah. I've been on Montserrat, where it seemed that there was some kind of maybe a religious quarrel between two factions on the islands of St. Kitts and Nevis, and the Irish picked up and moved to Montserrat. And
right.
But they call them Redshanks at the time.
That's right, exactly.
They probably died, I would think that they did not thrive, even if they hadn't been bred out by the larger numbers of Africans. I would think that they probably did not thrive due to skin cancer due to solar radiation.
Yeah, well, they were actually treated. I mean, again, this is a very controversial aspect of history, but we don't shy away from that at all. But a lot of them were actually murdered by the time, due to difference. There was an ethnic cleansing, basically, but of Irish this time, and a lot of people don't know that, you know.
Yes. Yeah, throughout all this, by the way, and I was raised Catholic, and have been always inspired by some of the priests and the nuns and the brothers with whom I was associated, who have lived out their faith doing wonderful works, wonderful self-sacrifice for the larger community. The hierarchical church participated in all of and and acquiesce to all of Britain's crimes in Ireland. And that is, that's just, it stuns me to think about it. And part, some of the payoffs are known, the amount of the payoffs are known. It's just desperately sad. So that the Christian, the Marist brother who taught me in Castlereagh some years ago, and one of my ex-classmates, I was pushing him very hard to stand up with a few of our ex-buddies, schoolmates, and accept a memorial over one of Castlereagh's three or four mass graves. And he was trying to avoid it, knowing that there's a social price to pay for to do this. And so he took my pamphlet to the brother who taught us all, then retired in Strokestown, and said, "Brother, I'm looking for errors in this. I'll see you in 2 weeks, and you tell me what you find." When he went back 2 weeks later, Brother Enda said, this pamphlet is true in all aspects." And this ex-student said, "Brother, how can you say that when it contradicts everything you taught us in school about the famine?" And Brother Enda replied to me in eternal shame and that of the government. He said, "I had no choice. I had to teach the curriculum as provided to me by the government." So he lived for 50 years of a teaching career where he did his very best in all other areas. He lied to his students about that part of Irish history.
Yeah. Very interesting. Now, let me ask you about some of the double standards and comparisons. I guess hypocrisy straight up would be the right way of addressing this, and also the lack of recognition both from the international community and other organizations and what have you around the world. Because, I mean, let's face it, the Jewish Holocaust is lifted forward like nothing else. Even when you say Holocaust today, that is what people think about, like they are the only ones who have suffered in history, despite that we know, as we mentioned here, we've had Holocaust of Armenian people, the Holodomor in the Ukraine, of course, the Russian people, a tremendous amount of Russians have been slaughtered, throughout history. And of course, now we have the Irish Holocaust that we're talking about here as well. And I find this a tremendous, hypocritical position to take, like that there's, I mean, in Ireland, as you said, there's no, we'll talk about your memorials, what you're working for here in a little bit, but I mean, they have an Irish Jewish, museum that are pushing, the Holocaust in Ireland, and they have a Holocaust Memorial Day. They even have a Holocaust Educational Trust in Ireland about the Jewish people, but nothing of their own. Why is that,
yes,
Chris?
You've just touched on maybe the most extreme example of control by others. The people of Ireland would like nothing more, nothing better than to honor those murdered and smeared people. They've not known were murdered then. They've been smeared ever since, slandered ever since. There's nothing that the people would like more to do than to do that. But those who control them are opposed. And I've asked Alan Shatter, the Senator Shatter, was one who was recently, just a year ago, accused the Irish people of being inadequately aware of the Nazi Holocaust.
Oh, my God. All right.
And I had to ask people I knew over there, where is the memorial in Israel for the Irish Holocaust?
Exactly, exactly. That's right.
And with more, by the way, it's important here to say that I did not use the word Holocaust out of my own head. I used it because of historical precedents. It was used in 1847 in the middle of the Holocaust. It was called the Holocaust. By the paper's still there. Now it's the Examiner. At that time it was in Cork City. It was called the Cork Examiner. It was referred to there. It was referred to Irish writers throughout at that time and since then. Particularly, it died out actually in the 1920s. But it was used during that time and for five or six decades after that. And so I used that word because it was the most apt one. When one thinks of the number of labels one can put on it, there's extermination, but that suggests no survivors, which should be inappropriate. There is genocide, which is perfectly apt, but no Irish person ever used that word, it having been coined by Raphael Lemkin about 1945 in describing what was done by Hitler. And I thought that belongs to them. Shoah, perhaps, and maybe even genocide. But, so I used the one that was available to me. And even even the Irish do not are being pushed by their betters. Quote, when you hear me say betters, think of betters within quotation marks.
Sure.
But that's what controls the people of Ireland, and they're very much afraid. It is the most fearful nation on earth, and that a Catholic priest who still has some respect in Ireland cannot get a mass grave memorial at the place where his mother was born in Northwest County Mayo. That is very sad.
Well, extremely sad. Exactly. I mean, it's amazing that when there is a kind of a non-story, it's lifted forward as the greatest tragedy of all history. But when there is a true crime like this, then it's, you know, covered up like nothing else. No one wants to talk about it. No one wants to address it. I even think you referenced that one of the, let's see if I can find her name here while I look in my notes. Yeah, there's an Irish person, Mary Robinson, right? She called it Ireland's greatest natural disaster. Like somehow it was just happened by a fluke, you know?
Yes. It's mind-boggling. And that's in a pamphlet handed out at what's called Ireland's Famine Museum in Strokestown, County Roscommon. And a pamphlet was handed out to us. And a mural on the wall, which showed some Asian nations, and you can only say Asian because the people in the field, bent over the fields, are all wearing conical hats. It is described there in that museum as Ireland being one of the nations that essentially committed national suicide by growing only one failure-prone crop.
Oh, man.
That is in that museum, in the same place where they hand out a pamphlet written by the president, the then president of Ireland, claiming it was a natural catastrophe.
Yeah, it's a tragedy for sure. So what do you think we should do here? Let's talk about what to do and of course, how to help the Irish people commemorate their ancestors and that they should get in a kind of a mode of recognizing this, beginning talking about this and of course not using this as a victim card as so many other groups do in our society today. It's not about that. I think that I'd be wholly against that in terms of politically trying to gain leverage just because you've been victimized historically. Unfortunately, we see way too much of that in these days. But nonetheless, it's about commemoration, recognizing that it occurred. It's a crime and saying that, you know, let's prevent this from happening in the future, right? Now, let's stop this cycle of genocide that we're seeing all over the place. So you've proposed, of course, getting up monuments and things like that. Tell us what you've been successful in doing so far, Chris.
So far, we only got up two successfully so far. The next one, I think, is going to be consummated tomorrow, but we were talking about the wording on the monument with the stonemaker exactly a year earlier. It has taken a year, so there's tremendous foot dragging, but we're finally forcing it. I'd like to say that here's what in chapter 13 of my book calls for. It'll take maybe 30 seconds, but
no worries.
Number one, spread the truth. Number two, excise, quote, famine, unquote, from our vocabularies regarding Ireland. It offends truth, dishonors the utterer, and constitutes false witness against the murdered millions. Three, politely but promptly correct all, including news media, who continue to refer to Irish, quote, famine, unquote, bracket, or, quote, potato famine, close bracket, or their Gaelic synonyms. Boycott institutions that teach Irish, quote, famine, unquote. Block proposed, quote, memorials, unquote, that don't name the perpetrating regiments. Install a reverent, truth-telling memorial over the Holocaust mass grave nearest to your ancestral home. Join with relatives and friends to do this. See exhibits A and 2 on those memorials. Do not fail to name the regiment that starved that district. Visit some of the mass graves and ponder the crimes. Observe November 3rd, Irish Holocaust Commemoration Day, annually with appropriate solemnity and respect. Remember that date commemorates two official events. One, the beginning of that Holocaust, and two, the beginning of the Big Lie famine campaigns. Next, locate and keep a register of all mass graves of Ireland's Holocaust. There is some evidence that in areas of fertile soil, those of denser populations, the mass graves are roughly a mile or two apart. Thus, there are probably more than 3,000 of what can be considered mass graves in Ireland. For now, contact me, FogartyC@att.net, with their precise addresses for registration. Means must be developed to ensure accuracy. And the final one is work to permanently preclude government policies of genocide. This will be partly accomplished by ending the cover-up of Ireland's Holocaust of 1845-1850.
Yeah. So, of course, making some of these, sites, setting up, monuments, memorializing the starvation, of course, the mass graves and what have you. What are some of the areas that you'd like to see some work being done? And also, is there anybody in Ireland at this point that is helping you with this and think that this is a good suggestion of doing something like this?
Yes, you see, the majority, in fact, almost everybody in Ireland wants this to happen. They're just terrorized by their leaders. Alan Shatter, imagine a welcomed and respected Jew living in Ireland accuses the people of Ireland of not being sufficiently attentive to the Shoah, the Jewish Holocaust.
It's amazing, yeah.
And he seemed to carry the day. The Catholic Church, it's a very delicate subject with the Catholic hierarchy because perhaps the vast majority of the people were not given Christian burials at the time. Now, at a certain stage, in a very short time, the sheer numbers overwhelmed all possibility for ritual. So it can't all be at all by any means held against them. But it's my understanding that before the numbers dying became very large, that the hierarchy did not want to consider that these were people with possibility for eternal life, that they were just not given Christian burials and were not permitted to be buried in consecrated ground. So that's another matter. The Catholic Church might have their own reason for trying to keep a lid on this.
Now, let me ask you if there's anything else that we haven't talked about here so far when it comes to the Irish Holocaust, and if there's any other components to it that you think we should mention to our audience here.
I really thank you for having allowed me this time. There probably is, and I must say I'm just not able to think of what we possibly missed at this stage. 5 minutes after this is over, I'll think of 4 or 5 things. But so far, I think you've covered the ground. In fact, it has never been, so in my memory, it has never been as well covered publicly as you have done this evening.
Well, that's really good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad we've been able to bring, shine a light on, of course, on this very dark area of history. But I wanted to ask you about something else. We're going to wrap up here in a little bit. I think we've covered most of what we wanted to do here in one segment today, Chris. Of course, it's an important story and more work should and can be done on it. But you also have the main website we've been talking about, of course, is irishholocaust.org, and I want you to mention your book in a little bit like this later, too. We'll talk more about that, where people can get copies and all that. But you have another website called terrorismireland.org, and I just quickly wanted to ask you a little bit about that and ask you in terms of your view on the IRA, and of course, we've been looking into some of the things in the past, actually, about how some of the British were actually, entrapment operations and things like that. I forget actually one of the organizations now, it'll come to me in a minute, that actually was found on a couple of instances to actually plant and blow up bombs themselves to be able to blame it on the IRA. I think it was the Research Unity Group or something like that, the RUA or something. But what's your view on the IRA?
I think they're part of Ireland's honorable history. There have been, I think, a few among them who have not lived up to that honorable avoidance of civilian killings, but their record speaks for itself. I was in the American Army. The record of my unit is not nearly as good as that of the IRA. So this notion that the IRA are terrorists, that's one more part of the lie, and it's a shame.
Yeah, the group I was thinking about is the Force Research Unit. I mentioned wrong there, but that they've actually been. I recommend people Googling that and look into that, because it actually shows quite a bit of how they nestled their way into there, and of course a lot of false flag operations is associated with that. But we'll save that for another time. It's a huge subject, of course, of how unfortunately a kind of a civil war type scenario has been going on in Ireland for many years. How are things today, though? Have you been back recently? I visited Ireland, it was a few years ago now, and things seem to have calmed down on that front a little bit. How are things there today?
they're a lot better. A woman stayed with us here last year from Derry. She and her husband, new husband, and she favors the current sellout, that is to say, the surrender of the six counties to Britain. It was disputed territory until the Good Friday Agreement. That called for a sign-over, a change of the Ireland's constitution, Articles 2 and 3, which laid permanent claim to the whole island. So it was signed over to the British. She said she lived in terror, never knew when she would die. Her husband was in prison, and the British soldiers used to come into her house twice a year, tear down the ceilings, rip up the floors, rip the kitchen cabinets off the walls, and go away, and then come back and do the same thing 6 months. And so she said that doesn't happen anymore. And she's been she has been broken. She could no longer tolerate that. And she accepts the surrender to the British government.
Hmm.
Is happy to do so.
Okay. All right. I wonder why. I wish all these countries would have their own independence back in Europe, you know, and we've been talking against organizations like the European Union for a long time due to the fact that the bigger centralized, decision-making gets, the bigger governments get, the worse it seems to get. And I would say the same here when it comes to Ireland, of being under the control of someone else. I'd like to see more local, smaller, independent, areas within all of Europe.
That's real democracy. Before we go, I'd like to mention the same FBI agent who framed me for triple murder of people of here in Chicago, of people I'd never heard of in my life, and would have gotten away with it. But the murderer actually blabbed through his FBI cover. He had used an FBI gun to commit the crimes. He blabbed through his FBI cover into life without possibility of parole. He's in downstate Pontiac prison to this day. That same FBI agent also locked up my wife and me and two others and tried to put us in prison for the rest of our lives based upon an audio tape that we proved in federal court 15 months later was a criminal fabrication.
Really? Why was this done towards you and your wife, do you think?
Because of the work we're doing. We're telling the truth at a time when important institutions do not want these truths spoken.
Yeah, but it's just bizarre, isn't it? But considering the FBI, there should be an internal American division, not doing the business of British-Irish relations, right?
Yeah, well, weeks before the Langridge family were murdered and blamed upon me, an FBI agent came to me and told me that MI5 had successfully bribed and subverted some of his colleagues and that they were planning crimes against my wife and me to silence us.
Really? Wow.
Yes. And so, but when I said, Joe, you're in law enforcement, we're not. What are you doing about this? When he said there was nothing he could do, I didn't believe any part of his story because I thought he would have to know about his own oath of office that required him to uphold U.S. Constitution at all times. If he didn't know that, I thought it was more likely that he had the whole story wrong. But the crimes took place. The same FBI agent who did all that was sent by MI5 to Ireland in 1993 or early 1994, and they remained there until the evening of August 15th, 1998, the evening of the murder of 29 people in Omagh, County Tyrone, to be blamed, like the Langert murders in Winnetka were blamed on the IRA. They've more or less managed to keep that blame on the IRA to this day.
Wow. Well, what a story. All I can say is, keep talking and stay brave, and of course keep up the good work, spreading the truth about this matter that we've been talking about. But as a final measure here, give us the websites once again, Chris, and also tell us, of course, how people can get a copy of the book. Let me mention the title here. It's Ireland, 1845 to 1850, and the subtitle is The Perfect Holocaust and Who Kept It, quote, Perfect, unquote. Where can we get a copy of the book?
I'm distributing them myself, so they'll have to contact me. And if you could be so kind, 900 North Lakeshore Drive, condo 1507, Chicago, Illinois 60611. And they're $20 each, plus if it's within the states, $3.15 postage each. Half of the 20 goes toward the installation of mass graves. Memorials over the mass graves. So this has been a huge sacrifice on my part, which I'm very, very happy to do. So if you pay $20 for the book, half that goes to memorial over a mass grave. This book tells the complete facts. It is far, far, far more complete than my website. In fact, something very important here. It was, my website said there were 75 British regiments removing Ireland's food. It was actually 67. That's the main error in that website and pamphlet. It was not 75 British regiments removing Ireland's food. It was 67. Not 75, but 67. And that was still over half the British Army at the time, because the British Empire Army at the time was 130 regiments. And I have two copies that were made for me by the National Archives in Kew outside London. It comes right off the original handwritten documents. I made the error came from my having used a book which they had promoted there, written by a man with the Mormons, and a wonderful two-volume set, but it's not entirely accurate. So, but anyway, my current book nails everything. It's absolutely true throughout the whole thing.
All right, very good. The website is irishholocaust.org, and if you click on what we must do there, you can actually get the address, the proper address here that Chris mentioned, and his email is right there as well in case you need to contact him. And then the other website is terrorismireland.org. Check that out as well. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Chris. Really appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
Before you go, could you say, what is my email address shown on that? Do you have it in front of you?
Yeah, the email is fogartyc@attnt.net. So it's att.net. That's the email on the website right now.
Thank you very much. That is correct. Thank you so very, very much.
You are the one.
new things to learn, new things to discover. There's just so much out there that we don't know about. Isn't it amazing? Well, we have much more coming, ladies and gentlemen, in just a few days. So please stay tuned. In the meantime, we direct you to redicemembers.com, our members' website, for much more, our entire archive. We have well over 900 programs on a lot of different topics, a lot for you to enjoy and learn more from. So do take a look in our archives. We have upcoming Nick Kelser, Mike King, John Friend, Sally Fallon, and Gilad Atzmon, to name a few. For now, I say thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. As always, great to have you with us. But please spread the word, tell the story, and of course, time to start organizing and lead, or find someone who can. Time to get brave and get it done. We'll talk to you soon.